Before I get started here, I'd like you to know that I have no conflicts of interest, bias, whatever, to disclose. And my topic today is providing sustainable communities in Alaska's rural and remote villages. And I'm going to focus on the importance of drinking water and sewer utilities in the changing Arctic environment. And the place where climate change and changes in environmental conditions is most evident is above the Northwest Arctic Circle. So that would be, there's 8 circumpolar north countries, but for the United States of America, this is our portion of the Arctic. This is the coal face. This is where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. And the Northwest Arctic world has about 11 communities in it. And I've been very privileged to work with their energy and resources coordinator and also a colleague at ANTHC, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. So Michael Black is the Director of Rural Utility Management Services, and I'd certainly like to acknowledge him for this presentation. So here's a picture from 80 to 89 of the mean annual soil temperatures at 1 meter of depth. And this is some modeling done at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. They have a number of brilliant institutes that are interested in scenario planning for climate change, SNAP, Scenario Network for Arctic Planning. And they also have an Alaska Center for Energy and Power, Alaska ACAP, a number of things at University of Fairbanks. And you can just see it's warmer on, this is the Aleutian Chain, and the area that we're going to kind of focus on a lot is this area up in here, which is the Northwest Arctic Burrow. And Nome is about right here, and Unalakleet, and so Norton Sound is here, and this is southwestern Alaska. And so these are where the climate change impacts are greatest, up on the Arctic slope. That's Inupiat, is the indigenous people there. A lot of these communities are 95% Alaska Natives. In Kotzebue, it's Inupiat, and Yupik down in southwestern Alaska. And I've done quite a bit of work there starting, well, I was in the Office of Governor in 1980, so my responsibility was for rural and remote energy planning and energy conservation and renewable energy. And so I wrote the first inventory and economic assessment of wind generators in Alaska, and that was published by the Department of Commerce and Economic Development in 1984. So in 2012, August 5th through 10th, we had the International Circumpolar Health Conference up in Fairbanks. And then I decided to write this article to see what had changed since I did all that work almost 30 years before, in the hopes of getting some epiphanies. So this is the kind of thing when you're doing scenario planning that you see when you're projecting into the future and you see how this is changing, or there's more areas with more permafrost melt. And this isn't a particular year, this is just an example of the. But this does tell you something. This is over a 60-year period. The total change in mean annual temperature in terms of degrees F. So this is the mean annual temperature, and you can see up here on your barrel and the Arctic slope, plus 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit. So this is what we worry about with the 2 degrees C and with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This is what we're going to see more of all across the country. There are some exceptions, of course, like the glaciers have been receding, and there's probably less than a dozen that are actually adding, but there's 12,000 glaciers in Alaska. So for all practical purposes, I mean, there's microclimates and other changes. But you can see this is kind of, this would get your attention if you're an engineer or a planner or involved in infrastructure. Here's another example, temperature increases at Point Hope. Point Hope is very far up, I showed you, in the Northwest Arctic Burrow. It's a coastal community. You can see what it looks like here. And 61 to 90, the average January air temperature was minus 3 degrees Fahrenheit, a drop. But by 2010, it was up 3 degrees F, and it's projected by 2040 to be up 6 degrees F. And so our current sanitation infrastructure is designed for conditions of the past, not the present or the future. So creating and maintaining healthy and sustainable communities, there's a lot of aspects of this. I think we got a little bit of a flavor for the social determinants of health, and that's what makes public health different Well, we've focused on populations, not on individuals, not on healthcare for individuals, but on the population, on things like poverty and greater social determinants of health, pollution prevention, those kind of piece. That makes public health different. And in this presentation, I'm going to focus on sustainable utilities, especially operation and maintenance of the systems that we have. But there's 25,000 people in rural and remote Alaska that don't have piped drinking water. And access, the sanitation is still honey buckets, which is a 5-gallon bucket that gets dumped in a sewage lagoon. So every governor, ever since I can remember, has always said, in my administration, we're going to get rid of the honey bucket. And guess what? It's a lot more difficult than you think. So we do a lot of collaboration with the Canadians and others, and there's a lot of collaboration between Inuit and various populations because there's similar cultural and ethnic factors. And when there's a population that's been there for 10,000 years and found a way to live in a sustainable way, we have a lot to learn from them. So Alaska is a different place. And that doesn't mean that's the only thing that creates a sustainable, healthy community. But that's what I'd like to focus on today. And there's many other areas that affect the relocation and sustainability of Alaska's rural and remote villages. And for better or worse, we're now looking at seriously the planning for several villages, and it should surprise you that they're coastal villages. And when they do things like the National Climate Assessment, and they do things like looking at climate change in Alaska at the federal government level, or the Government Accounting Agency, GAO, Government Accounting Office, they do a relocation study and they determine it takes $200 million to move a community that has less than 500 residents. Well, that's a really tough sell in today's budget climate. So the state of Alaska usually says, that's great, we'll have the federal government do that. We don't have the money for that. So now those issues are being studied, and there's some Alaska coastal impact grants and other things at the federal level to start look at what are our real options. So I mentioned the villages. A lot of them are 95% Alaska Native, and that's a pretty good number, actually, if you look across these villages. And they have unique cultural values, and the practice of subsistence affects food insecurity, or food security. There's a lot of factors that make living in these small communities of 200 to a big village would be maybe 1,000, like Hooper Bay. Selawik is very big in the Northwest Arctic of 895 or so. And so I mentioned the sustainable operation and maintenance. This is a worry. Also, the worry is the 25,000 people that don't have access to drinking water and sanitation, because we know there's public health benefits from a water supply. One of them is fewer skin infections, and another benefit has to do with respiratory ailments and respiratory illness, MRSA and all sorts of things, and hand washing. So we know there's a benefit. But when it costs $10 million to put in a water plant, that's a huge challenge for all of the entities that are involved in drinking water and sanitation. And I think if you followed global health, you know that at one point there were more than a billion people that didn't have access to clean drinking water. So now we've made a lot of progress with the Millennium Development Goals, and there's only 750 million people that don't have access to clean drinking water. That's a lot. And do you suppose we gave people drinking water first that were the hardest to serve? Or was it the low-hanging fruit? So these problems keep getting tougher. So nothing is taken for granted. And problems like climate change, as I'll show you, they're just making things worse. So we used to have a gap between how much we could fund for construction of facilities. Now it's looking more like a canyon. And now we're thinking we may lose some of the gains that we've already got. So we're a little bit worried. Now in Alaska, we depend 90% on oil in terms of royalties and taxes for to support the state government. Yeah, you heard me right. That's 90%. That's like a big number. And so when oil drops from $115 a barrel to $80 a barrel, 82, 78, there's lots of worries about what's going to happen now. And I think one of the things that's amazing is 2 days ago we had the existing governor conceded, so there's a new governor now. His name is Bill Walker, and he's a lifelong Alaskan, and his running mate was head of Sea Alaska Corp and is Alaska Native from Yakutat, and his name is Byron Lalotte. So they're going to expand Medicare. And they're going to, that's going to affect 40,000 people in Alaska. That's going to create 4,000 jobs. And they're going to tackle this problem of rural energy. And I think the sustainable infrastructure and stuff is going to probably get a little bit more attention because it's risen up now on the scale, kind of like melting permafrost brings water to the surface. So the rising sea levels is a concern with changes in water quality. Storm surge, seawater contamination, you get infiltration. Northward migration of animals with disease, like when beavers move in, they create giardia, things you know about in terms of various infectious disease. Saline intrusion into coastal groundwater, and increased algal growth. So lakes eutrophy when you get a lot of algal growth. They use up a lot of oxygen and things. And eventually they can just fill in. So that's one of the problems here that talks about the reduced supply of water to and drought effect on drying of tundra ponds. And there's regions of Alaska that are just, as far as you can see in the delta, they're just these shallow ponds and tundra ponds. And as these things dry up, or you build structures on things and the tundra doesn't recover, it affects everything. And the damage to intakes or impoundments comes from sediments, ice, and erosion. Here's solid waste disposal. The collection systems sometimes get destroyed or you lose access to them. So this doesn't look like a real romantic way to kind of manage your solid waste. The erosion intercepts the facility, which spreads waste. Flood water enters the facility, which spreads waste. And permafrost or waste melting also releases contaminants. A lot of this is a problem of scale with the numbers of people in these communities. Also, a number of these communities, more than you might imagine, have boardwalks. So that's how they get around. And the inability to use trails, roads, and boardwalks is caused by erosion and flood damage, storm damage, and melting permafrost. So there is an increased risk of disease and health complications. These sanitation utilities are affected by these changes in environmental conditions. Increased operational costs for water or wastewater systems. That's a problem because there's not a lot of jobs in these places. So people do get a permanent fund dividend, which is brilliant. When I worked in the governor's office, Jay Hammond was governor, and after Alberta, they had a rainy day fund, and they decided, well, why don't we create a fund for, you know, when we need it? So we have a permanent fund of about $50 billion. And to keep there's various theories on this, but I think when we were in the governor's office, the thinking was we don't want to spend all of the money we have coming in. And we have some people that's how they operate all the time. And that's how they please their constituents, is they spend everything that they can spend. So basically the permanent fund, by giving an annual dividend to all of the residents of the state of Alaska, you create a constituency for let's preserve the fund. So it's a little bit like being on a trust fund where you don't get into the principal, you just live off the earnings. And so Alaska has that, and that's very important for people that use that. But collection and the ability to pay for these utilities, they're very expensive, as you'll see. Okay, so that it also causes not only repair costs, but emotional and economic stress, and there are cases now where we're looking at relocation. In Unalakleet near Norton Sound in the southwestern part of Alaska, erosion's exposed to water line. So as you can imagine, you don't do a lot of construction on these things in the winter, once the winter comes to Alaska. So it's expensive to repair these things too. And this is a case of coastal flooding in Kotlik. So that looks something like out of a bad movie or whatever. So incidents of environmental challenges. In November 2000, the storm surge spread lagoon waste throughout Kipnuk. In December 2004, these are just some examples, the water crisis is a water source. There was saline contamination due to storm surge in Nunamiqua. That was formerly known as Sheldon Point. That's the Alaska Native name for it. And then in December 2004, the storm creates village water crisis due to water source saline contamination from that storm surge. Community water source disappeared in Quingagok, and that was June 2005, and there was also a warm weather warning. And we get paralytic shellfish poisoning and stuff with warmer water. And the West Coast was blasted by a storm in Nome, 2005, and October 2013, the Kotlik utility was destroyed by an ocean flood with ice. Another incident is we did a pilot in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region. That's southwest Alaska. We picked six villages to put drinking water and sanitation in, and six for a control. We did an evaluation of that, and as a result of that, we got millions of dollars from the Denali Commission, United States Department of Agriculture, Rural Development, and others. And today, that's known as the ARUC, Alaska Rural Utility Collaborative, and it's in 27 villages, and it's operating on a sustainable basis. One of those villages, however, 2 years ago, had a freeze-up of the water system in Selawik, and it cost over $450,000. So you can't afford to have another one of those once you've had that, and everybody pays for it that's in the collaborative. So there's huge challenges with these environmental challenges. So we need to adapt our infrastructure to climate change and the realities. Water and sewer, along with transportation infrastructure, is estimated to be most vulnerable to climate change. I will tell you that the drinking water and the sanitation systems are big-ticket items, but so is the gravel airstrip and some of those transportation things, too. They're big-ticket items. When you lose your water supply, you've got a problem, and that's what happened to Kivalina. They had that washout in a storm. The cost of not adapting infrastructure has been estimated in a 2000 study by one of our economists at the University of Alaska. There's this Institute for Social and Economic Research, and Scott Goldsmith now is a professor emeritus, but they estimated that the useful life of water and sewer infrastructure would be shortened by 3.5 years due to these changes in environmental conditions. And the engineers usually design things for a 20-year design life. So your economics change when you have to, when you're 16.5 years instead of 20 years. And the short leftover decades, it adds billions to preserving the sanitation utility. The rebuilding costs are estimated at $3 to $6 billion by 2030 for Alaska villages. And again, this seems to have come at just the wrong time. Now we're seeing all of these increased demands at the same time that the oil revenue and the state general fund is going down. It is a priority, climate change, on the current administration in Washington, D.C., and it is a reality. I mean, it's not really a debating thing with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the Fifth Assessment and polar regions. We know what we're facing. We just don't have a check that we can write and solve all of these problems with interventions. So I'll talk just briefly about Kivalina. They've been dramatically affected by climate change. They're up off the Northwest Arctic Burrow. They're on a small spit. Due to intense flooding and erosion, they have deficiencies in their sanitation systems, and they've been considering relocation. And ANTHC requested $250,000 to assist with portable, protected sanitation improvements for up to 10 homes. So this is very expensive. You can see what they estimated the total project cost at, and they're going to, in this housing, and the housing is kind of unique to the Arctic, but there's a cold weather research center up at the University of Alaska Fairbanks that's looking at even putting houses on sleds so they can be moved more easily. So there's a different kind of set of design challenges in Alaska. But the rain catchment systems can help with water supply, a water tank equipped to accept hauled water and rainwater that's added, and point-of-use water treatment device to treat water from non-potable systems sources. So this is much more economic than a pipe drinking water and sanitation system, for example. $10 million plant in Solana community with less than 500 residents. Gray water disposal systems, tank equipped to accept liquids that are discharged from the kitchen and bathroom sinks, urinal and separating toilet, and shallow brackish groundwater and gravelly soils are freeze-proof and environmentally sound for disposing of gray water. These are some of the solutions they're thinking about, including these particular toilets that are waterless toilets. This is called an Arctic box. This is what it attaches your system to the house, and these often break off. So there's a need for design and engineering innovation. You can see these homes. So the design of these homes and the number of heating degree days and challenges they face. Typically, in the old days, there were fish camps and other places, and people were, they tended to move around during the season. When they built a school, then it tended to tie everybody to this community. And so this is Kotlik, where they're trying to deal with designs that will withstand things like ice coming ashore from severe weather storms. And another problem are the ice cellars. They're filling up with water. So if you've got if you go hunt a bowhead whale and you bring a whale in, and the whole community has whale meat, but you put it in these ice cellars and it used to stay frozen and you could count on it. It's a different story when it's filling with water, and then you've got food safety and other issues. So food insecurity is a potential problem. And some of the engineers are designing some pretty innovative ice cellars, and some of them are community ice cellars rather than every cellar in every house. The problem when you have your own solutions is the electricity bills can be really high compared to what we're used to. I pay 13 cents a kilowatt hour in Anchorage. Many of these communities are well over 50 cents, and some of them up to $1 a kilowatt hour. So that's 3 to 6 times for electricity. And so we need design factors for engineers, historic and projected due to climate change impact, so that they can design better. And we do have some great engineers up there. But we don't really have the guidance. We don't really know exactly what we're doing right now. We're kind of discovering the faults of a one-size-fits-all kind of thing, like when we built clinics. So key points to address climate change: planning considerations or master plans that consider climate change impacts. Look at this from a community-wide standpoint. Engineering considerations include the infrastructure location and type. There's lots of different kind of water supplies, wells and run-of-the-river things and different treatment options. And then foundation design, wind and snow load, operational flexibility, affordable relocatability, and protected sites. Then we need to plan for relocation in some cases. This is what's going on with the Alaska Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. They've just issued about $500,000 in terms of a request for proposal on how do we work with these communities and how do we look at options. The GAO, Government Accountability Office, when they did a study, estimated to totally relocate Kivalina, $200 million. So the state of Alaska has not got $700 million to spend to relocate 5 communities at the bargain price of $140 million. It's a pipe dream. But if we don't start doing something about these villages now on day one and make them more sustainable and have systems that are more robust and resilient, then when we have a Hurricane Sandy kind of event and we say, federal government, please come save us, they're going to say, well, we would love to save you, but we could have saved you before Sandy, but we're sorry. And then the sustainability of communities has a lot of aspects of it, but I'd argue that energy costs, when they're paying $8 a gallon for diesel fuel in rural Alaska, in Anchorage it's more, a little under 4 now. So that's a problem for energy, and the energy costs affect, you know, drinking water, sanitation, and other utilities. So my conclusion is that Alaska's at the coalface of climate change. But everybody is going to be affected by climate change. And so this is where planning and engineering and public health, environmental health sciences and other things all come together, design interventions, but rather than working on the patient, we're working on the community. I'd like to acknowledge Mike Black. He's been a great friend, somewhat of a mentor in this area. I've done a lot of work with him since 2005 with John Spriggs, who was kind of the father of the Rural Utility Cooperative. And Ingemar Mathiasen is the Energy and Resources Coordinator, Northwest Arctic Borough in Kotzebue, Alaska. And these are some of my students who have all been researching various aspects of climate change. Irvi's been looking at mental health aspects and suicide and those kinds of things in communities. Rora's been interested in climate change policy. And Kim, Christina, Cassie, Stephanie, and Raina all tackle various aspects of how we create sustainable, healthy communities in rural and remote Alaska. What's really rewarding to me is to see that I have about 40% students that are Alaska Natives in my classes in an undergraduate public health program. And they're very excited about everything from obesity, diabetes, and traditional foods to sustainability and a variety of challenges that we face in Alaska, contaminants, this or that. And so we are the last great frontier. That's my commercial for Alaska. It's not the strongest of the species that survives, nor the most intelligent that survives. It's the one that is most adaptable to change that survives. And we're still in the same boat. This isn't one vulnerable population rather than another. So that's my presentation today. Thank you very much. So at this point, I'd like to invite our presenters up to the podium here. And we have a good 10 minutes, 15 minutes for any additional questions. So come on up. So I'd also like to encourage the presenters, if you have questions based on another presentation that you saw, feel free to come up here to the podium and state your question. But these issues that have to do with asthma and have to do with green-collar jobs or have to do with sustainability / climate change, they're big challenges for public health, and they aren't necessarily all areas. Some of these are emerging things. And that's what the public health field is. We're one of the faces of the challenges. We're right at the edge here. So can I get a question from the audience? Is there anybody that would like to start things off? And just raise your voice. I think we're close enough. If not, feel free to come up here to the mic. Yes.
I noticed you have J-shaped association between asthma prevalence and severity and your density measure. And I was wondering, is there any association between unpaved roads and respiratory issues, unpaved roads, dirt roads? Because they generate a tremendous amount of particulates in the summertime.
I do know that in Superfund history, one of the Superfund sites, it's the reason for the creation of the program was in Times Beach, Missouri, where they were using dioxin contaminated oils to basically knock the dust down. And so sometimes the solution is worse than the problem initially with allergies and with asthma by using contaminated, and also sometimes contaminants are put in, fertilizers and other things as kind of stabilizer. So I think that's a good point that there's probably a, this is a good measure to look at the density function, but there's also other issues that may be important, like this issue of developed versus undeveloped. And I would think that, you know, a confounder that I ran into when I was living in the high desert in Washington was we'd go down to places like Walla Walla, and in certain times of the season, all of the stubble and stuff from the fields, they would burn. And so the whole place was full of this acrid smoke, and you couldn't breathe. And I can't imagine having asthma and have to deal with air quality issues like that. But it's also an issue with forest fires, which you find in the western United States. So being able to identify those confounders, and because this is really about, we know in big cities with lots of industry and lots of cars, their quality is of a certain nature, and kind of looking at the smaller cities, they're not exactly imprints of the bigger cities, but that's what we were really after.
Yeah, but at the same time, in large cities, I still believe that the poor housing conditions may occur at the same place that traffic exposure, you know, that the same neighborhood are prone to both kind of exposure. And honestly, in previous studies, I haven't found many studies who really took well into account that kind of a confounder. And as a public health officer, we often get some calls of the population because they get some mold problems or, you know, pet exposure, and a lot of asthma symptoms that are more related to the indoor environment rather than the outdoor. So I'm just surprised that the other researchers haven't integrated these confounders into the study.
It brings to mind, I have a friend that works in transportation, and he's a planner in Boston. And at one point they had a major freeway, I think it was called the South Central Freeway. Not absolutely sure about that, but it just cut the heart out of downtown. And they had I-93, which went up north. And they took that whole highway down. So and then made it a green belt and everything else. So if you could do air pollution studies on people that were living under the freeway, and what kind of shape they were in, and then after, you know, the new freeway, that might give you a comparison study. Any other questions out there? Yes, please.
If there's a lot of weight here, excessive weight around the neck, that impacts on in-depth the compliance of the monks and leads to difficulties in creating. So it's rather an anatomic explanation that translates to long compliance in the physiological mechanism.
Is it a little bit like a restrictive syndrome?
There is a restrictive problem with respect to how the lungs comply.
Yeah.
Not only that, that's one aspect we're looking at. So our next step is to see if we go into the biological markers. So these people have been known to have increased level of interleukin 6, which is a pro-inflammatory cytokine. So it is worthwhile to look at if your neck circumference here translate to IL-6. Does it also translate to the tumor necrosis factor alpha, which has been involved in obesity in general and also involved in asthma itself? Does it translate to adipokinase? Those are the biological markers that lead to adipocyte dysfunction. So if the adipocytes are dysfunctional, we are translating those dysfunctions to obesity directly. But because the same biomarkers are driving asthma, inflammation, so we could then link these two to that. But the challenge is that to confirm those biological markers and link them to neck circumference, we've got to put in an intervention, for example, dietary restriction or exercise, to see whether those two approaches would lead to a reduction of those biomarkers in order to confirm them. The reason why this becomes necessary is that most of the biological markers for asthma that we've been dealing with have been known in the adult population, and most of those markers have not been validated even in the adult population. So pediatric medicine has got a challenge to get back to the drawing board, get in fact these biological markers to see how they drive this inflammation in children and then predispose to asthma.
Excellent. Okay, well, I would like to thank you for coming to our diverse topics in epidemiology too. I think one of the nice things about the diverse topics is we get a series of papers and we have a lot in common, as well as a nice breadth. So enjoy the rest of the conference. The closing session is this afternoon, and I wish you safe travels, and thanks a lot for being here. Take care.